You're listening to Face Off, episode 31, recorded August 16th, 2009. Welcome to Face Off, your face-to-face web technology podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Jade Robbins.
And I'm Mark Sanborn.
And in this podcast, we like to talk about various aspects of web technology, such as web development, social media, and web entrepreneurship. As always, you can view our show notes by going to faceoffshow.com or follow us by going to twitter.com/faceoffshow.
All right. You've got some kind of sad news
here. Oh, yeah. So, well, it's like one thing. Someone around here is cooking some food outside, and it smells awesome. Yeah, follow up this week. So before the show, Mark and I always try and do a couple things to like pump up, you know, so that we can have a lot of energy for the show when we record, because we've recorded a couple shows when we weren't fully pumped up and it just ends up pretty poor. So we usually like listen to some tunes or play the Xbox 360, but this week my Xbox died.
No Madden, what is it, 10?
Madden 10, yeah, we've been playing that. I can't beat you anymore.
Yeah.
But it's just a really sad situation with these, with just Xboxes, 360s in general. I mean, first of all, it's sad because I thought the situation had died down. I mean, there was a while there where the red ring of death, which I didn't get the red ring of death. I got error code 74, which is pretty much the same thing, I'm told, according to Microsoft anyways.
Yeah, I don't even own an Xbox, never have, and I know what the red ring of death is, yeah. So it's pretty popular. Or pretty,
I wouldn't say prevalent.
It's out there.
Yeah, and so I'm bummed. But I thought, I've had mine for almost 2 years now, so I thought, well, if it's going to die, it would have died already.
Yeah.
And then this morning before the show, we went to start it up, and it was blinking red lights and crap, so I'm bummed.
My first thought that it would be some kind of issue with the hard drive, because usually hardware doesn't really go bad. But you're saying that the Error 76 online was talking about GPU
supposedly,
errors and weird
yeah.
stuff like that?
Yeah, most of the Red Ring stuff with the Xbox 360 were related to the GPU, as far as I know.
Probably overheating or something.
Yeah, probably. So, bummer on that. But it's just, I don't really know what this does with what this has to do with web technology, but it's just kind of a bummer. So if I'm kind of depressed during the show, like if I pout my lip out a little bit more than usual because my Xbox died. So, all right, let's kick it into our web apps.
We've got the Blind Search app. This is kind of cool, actually.
Yeah, what this is after you.
Oh, I was just going to say it's a website where you go to search and it will pull up search results from a couple different websites, and it won't show you who the provider is on purpose because, you know, blind.
Yeah, exactly.
Testing. And then you kind of say, oh, this one provided the best results.
And then you click to see which one it actually was. It's does Google, Bing, and Yahoo search.
Yep.
Which will be fairly redundant here pretty soon when Yahoo fully integrates Bing search. But it's just a cool way, you know, because some people, they always say, especially with Bing just being announced, people are kind of like, well, it's giving me really terrible search results, and I think it's dumb.
Yeah,
And this is kind of a way to test that. Like, well, is it? And then, are you just being biased and being sort of a Microsoft hater?
Mm-hmm.
Which one? So, what have you found? Some of your results that you've been searching with it.
A lot of the search engines kind of come up with a similar thing.
Exactly. That's the funny thing. That's totally what I'm finding is that they come up, especially the first one or two results, are all the same. I mean, if you search for Face Off, the first result on all three of them is the movie.
Is it a Face Off movie?
Yeah, I remember John Travolta and Nick. Oh, what's his name? Who did Raising Arizona, National Treasure?
Nicolas Cage.
Nicolas Cage. Yeah. So, like the
this is interesting. So I was looking at these three and I was like, oh, these two over here they're kind of good. I think they're beating this one over here. And it was Yahoo and Bing.
Ooh.
Google was getting the lower one on this.
Oh.
Interesting.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's kind of one of those put your money where your mouth is things. So if you hear someone that says, like, well, Bing just, you know, gives bad search results, be like, okay, well, take this test. I want to see what you come up with. So, I mean, interestingly, if you just search for Face Off, the middle one actually brings up. Oh, no, that's that. Never mind. We are not faceoff.com. We are not a hockey podcast. But check it out. I mean, you might be surprised as to which search engines are giving you the results that you really like. So, you know.
So the guy that made this does work at Microsoft, but he's saying this is not a Microsoft project, and he's just doing it in his spare time, and it's not affiliated.
Well, this is kind of fun. Kind of cool and fun. But yeah. You know, check it out. It's at blindsearch.fegis.com. All right, let's move on. Our next web app is called Speepo. Speepo. And what Speepo is a web app that allows you to record audio and then, you know, email that link to a friend or just get the link or embed it in your website. And it just plays back your recording. You know, it's kind of like a voicemail for the web. So, like, if I want to leave you, you know, a voicemail, I just record something and then send it to your email address.
Ooh. Yeah, or you could just give a URL and do an IM chat or...
Yeah, or embed it on your website. I thought that was kind of a clever use of it. You know, if you want to like record a hello for when people come to your website that doesn't play automatically or something.
Yeah, audio recording is some kind of a pain. It's like, what app do I use? How do I set my audio settings and things? And this one uses Flash, is it?
Yep.
And it just kind of takes over your settings and kind of...
Yeah, it just uses Flash. It's web-based. When you first log on to it, you know, it asks you the basic Flash stuff, if it can access your camera or your microphone. And you hit yes, and then you hit record, and you get a link and play it back. So here's one I recorded a little earlier. This is Face Off Show testing out Speepo. You know, pretty clear, pretty simple, nothing fancy.
Yep.
It also has some really cool features. So if you don't want to just record audio, you can go to their webcam site up at the top, and you can record video and audio and leave it, you know, on someone else's webpage. Or if you want, you can create a private page, which is also pretty cool. It allows you to sort of create a private page where you and other people can record things. And when something is recorded on that private page, it emails you and lets you know.
Huh.
So.
Yeah, and it even has this, like, do not delete this ever or delete this after 4 weeks. That's pretty cool. So like you said, if you wanted to embed it, you don't want it just to disappear someday.
Yeah, exactly.
So that's kind of cool.
But really simple. I mean, I'm not really sure how long it'll be around. That, you know, they might throw ads on it, but just a fun, simple little app. You know, leave voicemail for all your friends. You can be that annoying Facebook person that sends little voicemail snippets everywhere.
Little voicemail Twitter tweets or something.
Yeah, exactly. And people will be like, I am so tired of these. They are not funny. All right. So let's move on to our next web app. We're just rolling through them this week. The next one is called OCR Terminal. And what OCR Terminal does is OCRs, which stands for Object Character Recognition.
Okay.
I believe Object Character Recognition.
I'll look it up for you.
Basically, it looks at an image that has words in it and transforms it into text for you. And puts it in a text thing. So, I mean, if you have a scanner, like a lot of scanners come with OCR software and stuff. But if you just don't have any OCR software and you just have an image that you want converted into a docket, you know, or to pull the text out of, go up here, upload it. You get 19 pages for free by default. If you want more, you have to pay for it.
Yeah. It's optical character recognition.
Optical.
And the thing about OCR is it's always like, how good is it? So before we, you know, just say, you know, this is the greatest web app since sliced bread, we always have to test these kind of things. And how did it work?
It worked pretty well. I didn't use the best image in the world. I was kind of mad, but it does a lot of cool things. Like it did, it was easy to notice mistakes and fix them. Yeah, okay. I would say when you get into these things, you basically sort of talk about like what percent correct, you know, like 99.8.
Yeah, bottom line, if you have to retype the entire thing, and I mean, that's a lot of work. If you can get 80%, that's saving you time. If you can only get 20%, probably
but
not.
Still, that's a pain. Like 80% is still even a pain.
True.
Because let's say if you're doing a bunch of pages, you have to go through
read through it all again.
Yeah. But again, it does save you the time to have to retype the whole damn thing. Uh-huh. That's okay. It's pretty good. I wish I had a crisper image to test it with. I didn't. I kind of just gave up and said, oh, well, it works. But it does a pretty good job. The one thing we did try was we put in a scan of the Declaration of Independence, and that did not work at all.
It didn't. And it didn't recognize that nice, fancy cursive handwriting.
Yeah, exactly. We were joking, and I was like, I don't think I can even read this in fancy handwriting, so I don't think I should blame the software for not being able to do it.
It was the ultimate test, I'd say.
But, you know, here's the funny thing I actually found out by doing this. I was looking for just images of a document to try it with. The Girl Scouts have a lot of documents online scanned in images.
Really?
You'd be surprised. Yeah. Weird. They really need to put them in PDF. But speaking of PDF, so we talked about this earlier. A lot of PDFs, when people scan them, they basically scan them as an image and put the image in as a PDF. Uh-huh. So if you do want to extract the text out of it with we did a web app earlier that did that.
PDF to Word. We're going to talk about it a little bit later, yeah, too.
If you do that, it won't work because it can't... It is an image. It's not text. That PDF to Word literally grabs the text out of the PDF and doesn't do OCR. This will. Okay. If you have a PDF that is just a giant image, you can upload it to this and it will actually OCR that text and convert it into a usable text format.
Now, that PDF to Word actually will do a little bit more than just pull the text out. It'll actually take the forms. If you've, like, for example, if you have like a horizontal line break and things like that, it'll grab that kind of stuff too.
But if you have just a PDF that has a scanned image in it,
yeah, it probably won't work.
You're no good.
This will.
It probably won't do as great of a job as PDF to Word about making the forms and stuff because it's trying to look for text and stuff. But this will save you time. You can do it, and then hopefully, I sort of hope the sort of distributed method of this is people will take all those images that are these documents that are scanned as images, convert them into a usable text format, reformat them to look right, and then give them back to the person in a usable format so that they will stop doing that.
Yep,
this happens to me at work all the time. All of our forms are either just scanned PDFs or nothing useful at all.
Uh-huh.
It drives me nuts because they won't, make it so I can fill out the form, or it is a Word doc and the form itself is a bunch of underscores and I go to type in it and the underscore starts, it just drives me nuts.
Some more features of this thing, it's a web app, but it also has a desktop client. So if you, are doing a lot of conversions, you want to scan it in real fast, you might want to go that route. It also has an API if you're, making some sort of an app that requires OCR. Mm-hmm. And want to take advantage of their features.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure there are some open source OCR softwares out there, and I wouldn't even be surprised if this used them in the back end, but this is a web app to do it, and a desktop app that probably has a nice interface. With, if you did Linux, I'm sure you could sudo apt-get something to do it, but it might be a little more difficult to use than you would like. But check it out, OCRterminal.com.
The next app we kind of got is kind of like a entrepreneurial, if you're doing your own website, you'll always see the privacy policies in terms of services, and if you're making kind of a site, it's good to have these kind of things.
Mark, I can't afford a lawyer to write one for me. I'm bootstrapping a small business here.
Well, if you can't find one on, what was it, DocStock?
True, yeah.
Then what this is a privacy policy terms and service generator. And I did it, and I looked through it, and I read through each word, and it's pretty generic, but it covers your bases. Mm-hmm. For example, if you link out to a site that was good at one point and then all of a sudden it got hacked or changed and now there's pornographic images or something and you link to it, you're not responsible for the links you put out.
Mm-hmm.
Things like that can happen.
Yeah, you can get in trouble for that.
It's just good to have these generic blanket statements.
Yeah, I mean, it's just got
kind of cover yourself.
Stupid little things that you and I would not think of but someone has come across at least once in the past that will cover that base for you.
And also the privacy, you want to get your terms out. A lot of these, we found out last week about Digsby they had some goofy things in their privacy. They're going to use your computer to do goofy stuff. This privacy statement is really short. It's only a couple paragraphs long, and it's like transparency. You want to say this is it. We're not going to collect your information, or if we do, we're not going to sell it.
Exactly. Just for a standard website that will have probably someone log in and do something, great. Or if you have a blog, you put a link in your footer that says terms of service, and you're covering a lot of your bases.
Yep. The URL is quite long, so you'll have to go to the show notes if you want to check it out. It's pretty simple. You just type in your company name or website name and the state that you're in, and it'll generate a generic, decent privacy policy in terms of use.
Yeah, at least covers your butt, and you should do that. At least try and get some basic protection instead of... I mean, I'm sure, let's say, if someone linked to, one of the links that you had on your website got hacked and turned pornographic and someone visited your website and went to that link and got fired... I'm sure that wouldn't stand up in court, but it would still have to go to court, and there would still be a big annoying hubbub about it. That way, at least when they serve you with any papers, you say, "Hey, you agree to the terms of service."
One of those things that you never think is going to happen, but you might as well you should have it. And for the privacy policy, it's for your users a lot of it too. I mean, Some users are concerned and they want to check out the privacy policy and see what kind of information you're collecting and are you selling it to people, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah,
and
definitely.
And this one is it's kind of like we're gonna abide by all the laws. We're not gonna give your information away. It's pretty generic.
Yeah, and this one is so easy to use and generate. It takes no time, so just do it.
Yep,
I'm gonna do it on my websites after this.
Okay, so that's.
That's it for our web apps. If you guys have some web apps or some news and feedback that you want us to take a look at, just go to faceoffshow.com/feedback and let us know. We'll check it out. And if you leave us a voicemail or something, we might even play it on the show. So go do that now.
All right. So for our first topic, it's kind of a entrepreneurial slash web design mm-hmm. style topic. And that's 22 things you can do right now to make your website more credible.
Definitely.
The first one is have quality content.
Yeah, we say that a lot. I mean, the way to survive in this world, and it's sort of what we call like the Gary Vaynerchuk gospel, is just to have the chops. If you have the chops, then it will happen for you. If you, you know, are dedicated and just put out good stuff, then it will get recognized as such.
Yep. Don't be like keyword stuffing and just making random content just to make content. Try to make your content really have quality attributes to it. You know, check for spelling, grammar, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. And just, you know, don't have half of your post be, I'm sorry, I don't post anymore.
Yeah, that kind of stuff.
Number two is make consistent updates. You and I hammer this a lot. You really need to make sure that you're doing a lot of updates because it's, if you think about it, a lot of people, they do this subconsciously, not really on top of their head, but they, if you're not going to invest the time in it, they don't want to invest the time with you.
Uh-huh.
Like with me, I'm kind of, I have a little like OCD. So if I put something in my, you know, my feed reader that doesn't post regularly, it bugs me because I feel like there's a bunch of like sort of hanging things that I need to get rid of that I don't have. And I think a lot of the people feel that way.
Yeah. Even if it's not like a major, you know, you don't always want to just majorly change your site over, but little tweaks here and there just to let people know that you're evolving and your site is changing and you're offering new features or you're planning on it.
Yeah. What is it they say that you, as a business, you should change your homepage at least once a year, at least in some visible way?
You do want to be careful. I mean, if your users are used to a certain type of layout and you totally throw that out the window and change it, be careful of that. But make tweaks and graphical changes.
Change your color scheme. Maybe change your, you know, if you, especially if you have like, you know, stock images on your homepage, refresh those once in a while so that this looks like it makes you look active at least. Even if someone isn't, you know, someone might not check my website every day, but when they do, they'll go, oh, well, cool. He hasn't given up on this yet.
Yep. Number three is display real world contact information. Sometimes in the contact, they'll just have like a form. You see this on blogs, and that's usually okay for a blog. But when you start to get to a more serious kind of a website, you're going to want to have things like an address or a phone number where they can contact your business.
Yeah, I would say that this is even changing that if you even have just an email address or even like your Twitter stuff, that adds just a little bit more to it, especially something like Twitter because they can go to it and see that you're active. And then it's like, okay, so this is a real contact method. I am actually getting to someone.
Yeah, Twitter's been actually becoming faster than a phone. I mean, it's like, hey, I'm having this problem and somebody from like a Twitter representative for the company is going on Twitter and saying, oh, sorry, you know, and responding to because it's a public forum and they really need to respond and keep on that. So Twitter's actually becoming a good place to get customer service. Mm-hmm.
Well, the thing is, it's just if you have like a contact form or even just an email, it's you're sending it off to nowhere. You don't really know where it's at. But if you like Twitter, you can see that they're actually doing stuff with it, that they're actually there. You know, you know that they aren't just sending it off into la la land.
Mm-hmm.
And if they don't respond to you, they're purposely ignoring you.
And, you know, a lot of objections that come up when you say this kind of stuff is, well, what if the spammers get my email address or my Twitter account name and they start following me and having all those requests? Well, spammers are going to get it anyways.
And that's going to happen if you get good. I mean, unfortunately, if the better your blog gets, the more spam is going to try and hit it, you know, because it's going to be more relevant. It's going to get more traffic. Yep. It's just going to happen anyways. The best way you can do is insulate yourself internally with your own processes or your own, you know, like use Gmail. I don't get email spam because I use Gmail.
There's a few things you can do, like detect if there's JavaScript enabled and then like not display the email and things like that. But don't go out of your way to make it hard for the user to find the contact information.
Again, it's a good thing, at least. If you are having the problem of your email address in your website is so popular that you're getting spammed, that's better than the former of being, you know, getting anything, yeah, exactly. Where no one needs your contact information because no one's using your stuff.
Number four is include search functionality, and this is actually a tough one. I have to say I hardly ever use a search box in a website because I find in general that I never get what I'm searching for.
Hmm.
Unless it's like a Google site search.
Yeah, I agree. I don't know. It just depends on what you're talking about. Are you talking about a blog? If a blog, I think a search is essential.
Hard. It's anything. If I go to like HomeDepot.com or Walmart.com, they have a big search engine. I type in like I want a nail, 4-inch nail or something weird.
You
like
buy
that.
Nails online, huh? That's,
no. this is me coming up with examples on the spot that make no sense.
You never get what you want. You never. Know,
it's faster to go to what is it, browse and then like say hardware. Metal nails or, you know, something like that.
Yeah, exactly. Especially e-commerce websites are really difficult. Like you said,
Amazon's is good. Like if you're searching for a book title or something, it's really good. But there's a lot of sites where the search is just terrible.
That's why I just went with the Google site search on mine, because it seems to be about the easiest way to go.
And in this article, they're actually recommending if you don't have the time to program your own search engine, check out Google's custom search. Because it's not like you're sending them off to Google. You can actually embed it in your site.
Oh, yeah. And it's a piece of cake. I did it in WordPress in half a second, and it blew my mind how easy it was.
It looks like it's obviously coming from Google, but who cares? Relevant results versus your custom programmed.
Yeah,
chances
exactly.
are, unless you're Amazon or someone really big that has time to invest in search.
Yeah. Or if you're small enough that you know when people search for things, that they'll get it. But for the most part, I agree. I think that you need at least something. Just something at least. Better than nothing.
Yeah. It also depends on the size of the site. Some sites only have maybe a dozen pages.
And you're like, well, why are we searching here?
Yeah.
But it just, like, I guess the whole point of the site is to make you seem, or not seem, to convey your credibility.
Right.
That's kind of a bad title if you think about it. To make your website, it says make your website more credible. I thought it said make your website seem more credible. The whole point here is to actually be credible. And if you're credible, then you should at least be credible enough to get a Google site search up for people to find stuff.
Number five is, letting people know, or letting people have a feedback.
Yeah, make it obvious.
Making a feedback on every single page, whether it be the bottom or the top. When somebody starts to get frustrated, the last thing you want is them, having to click five different pages to find the feedback.
Yeah, I mean, that's why on Faceoff we have feedback as a primary link up top. We tell everybody to go there because if you are credible, then if someone has a complaint, you have a real response to it. Or if they're right, then you are credible enough to say you are correct and I was wrong and thank you for letting me know that.
Right.
You know, it's when you get shady, if you're like this shady sort of stuff, it's when you wonder, you know, they're like, well, we don't want them to actually give us feedback. We live on that. I want as much feedback as humanly possible. Even if you hate the show, I want you to tell me about it because then I want to know maybe why you hate it and how I can fix it.
Yep.
You know?
Exactly.
Number six is avoid too much info, which they call e-dribble, the SEO trap, which is you hear this so much. Everybody says, and we've talked about this before, and I'm pretty passionate about it. They say, man, I want SEO. I need to optimize my website so I get higher search rankings.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem is if you don't have good content or relevant stuff, you are cheating. That is cheating. If you are trying to get higher results when there are more relevant people, that are getting missed, that's cheating.
Not only is it possibly cheating, it's distracting.
There's
a lot of, when they go to the site, there's so many articles, there's so many pieces of text, they don't even know what they're looking at.
Yeah. And the problem was it didn't used to affect the user because search engines went all on meta tags, but it just made meta tags useless. And the sort of same thing is happening with text. If you have so much junk that you're just trying to get search results, I mean, we've talked about this before where we were like, well, maybe, this is kind of related. Maybe we should put this in our tags or in our, or in our title. And it's like, well, no, it has to be relevant. You don't want to fool people because then they get angry and they can see through that. People can see through that. We're not stupid.
So instead of spending your time writing a bunch of SEO garbage, focus on design, navigation, and usability.
Yeah.
This is what's going to keep people coming back. The SEO stuff, sure, you can have a big glob of text all over the screen, but if the user goes there and they see this and they're going to say, oh, I'm out of here. Whereas if it's easy to use, the navigation, the design is appealing, the navigation is easy, and it's usable, they're going to stay and they're going
to
come back.
Exactly. Regular visitors are the ones that are easily more easily converted to money. That sounds dirty, or that sounds kind of like cattle talk, but it is. If you have people that are loyal to you, then when you launch new ventures, they're going to be the ones that will be loyal enough to go try it out and trust your opinion on it. Those are just, you want more people. And if, you know, you're focusing on making it easier for people that are coming back a lot to get around your site and find the information they want, then that's better.
Number 8 is to display security badges, and these are like the 128-bit encrypted SSL thing. And
secure, safe, hack checked daily. I think these are stupid. I think the article's totally wrong on this.
From a kind of a developer standpoint, I look at them and say those mean absolutely nothing because they don't for security. Yeah. But for the masses, I'm wondering if there's any studies or anything, surveys that have been shown. That people are more trusted when they see these kind of things.
I'm not sure.
Because I don't feel any more.
But someone like my mother might. That's what I'm kind of concerned about. Yeah. Right. I don't know. I mean, the way I would go about it is I would have a page on my website that talked all about security.
Yeah, you can maybe have like secure, you know, with a question mark. And you
maybe
can click on
it. Maybe make my own badge or something at the bottom that says, you know, read about our security, and it goes and talks to that. I don't like the pre-made badges and stuff.
Or simply say, instead of like checkout, say checkout using our secure server or like something like that. But you don't need to have 5 badges at the bottom of your site saying
no,
that you're
check daily, a trusted check today.
Business and all that stupid stuff.
I know, I hate those. Number 9 is include testimonials. This is another one I'm kind of torn on. I don't know.
I think this one's, it can go both ways. I think if it's obvious that anyone that has purchased the product can write a review on it, and it's like a person, an actual person, a username or something, it's absolutely great.
Yeah.
I trust it every time. But if it's something that's just like this big letter that somebody sent or something, and it's just a static page, you're like, did they make it up?
And it just depends on how they wrote it, too. If, you know, let's say, for example, if they were like, Montana Frag Fest gave me, you know, really good news in a way that I enjoyed. I thought it was really funny. Like, I would trust that. But if they're like, Montana Frag Fest is my premier source for video game news, you know, I'd be like, whoa, that sounds like, you know.
I mean, if it's obvious that a user wrote it, like maybe there's a grammar mistake and spelling mistake, and it's got like 4 stars out of 5, and like you can see that on the bottom it says submit your own review.
Yeah.
And stuff like that where it's obvious that a person is actually generating these, I think they're great.
Yeah, or if it's transparent, like if that person with the testimonial has a webpage and you'll put a link to their webpage so you could, if you wanted to, get a hold of that person and be like, hey, was this really you?
And even if they're moderated, I mean, they kind of have to be.
Yeah.
It's still better. I mean, if you had it that way,
I wouldn't want a review on my own site that said, you know, poo poo, doo doo, you know, on it or something. So, yeah.
Number 10 is write a detailed about page. This is, you know, on the lines of being more transparent and showing who you actually are.
Tell your story.
Credibility.
People love stories. Stories are great. You know, I'm the type of person that will sit and read a Wikipedia article about a company and just read the sort of beginning, like, you know, like how Berkshire Hathaway got started. That's just crazy. You know, it was like a company, but and then it just turned into Warren Buffett's holding company. You know, and you're like, that's just nuts. So I mean, it doesn't take you that long to do, and if it will give you, you know, more credibility and allow people to trust you, you might as well do it.
Yep. Number 11, and we have the privacy generator for this, is display clear terms of service.
Yeah, number 11 and 12. 12 is include a privacy policy. Just like we talked about, there's a great way to do it above, which is where we got this from this article. You might as well do it. Like we said, covering your butt is always a good idea.
Number 13 is make a print CSS file.
Yeah, this is so easy to do, and it just makes it so much easier. I know you're not supposed to print. People get angry because of the environment and stuff like that, but people print stuff. You're not going to change it. I'm proud. I'm saying it loud and proud right now. I print stuff, all right? You know, trees are a renewable resource. I don't care. I print stuff because it's easier to read for me. So make a print style for it, you know? And actually, if you really are concerned about the environment, you should make a print style sheet, because then it will only print in the amount of space that it needs to. You're not printing off all these extra junk in your...
an extra page that just has the footer on it or something.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, if you really are concerned about the environment, make a print style sheet. You know, make the font size in the print style sheet like 8 or something, you know?
And also, if somebody, for example, prints off an article and reads it and says, this is a great article, and then passes on to a friend... and then they're looking at it, and the layout's just awful, and the text is in a weird spot. It doesn't look good for you.
Yeah.
If it's a nice, presentable thing, and it's got your logo right up on the top and everything, you're going to have a little bit better exposure.
Yeah. I mean, the need for a web app like Print Friendly that we talked about that will take a website and make it print friendly for you just shows how much people need to be doing this instead. Mm-hmm. That app should not be needed. You should be doing it right.
Number 14, make a site mobile ready.
Yep. I cannot stress this enough. I have an iPod Touch and like a Windows Mobile 5 phone, which is kind of old. But I mean, just even having a mobile style sheet that just strips all the junk out and makes it easily to navigate is so nice.
Now, I would say give the person the option to go see the regular site, though. Don't just move them to the mobile one and then don't give them any options.
Yeah.
Because the problem is some phones are actually really good at displaying the original source.
Oh, the iPod Touch.
The iPod Touch. And sometimes you'll get redirected to this less featured page, and you're like, I want to go back to the other one.
Yeah, exactly. So give them the sometimes option. The iPod Touch browser, which is Safari, is just superior to anything else I've seen on a mobile device. Number 15 is avoid stock photos and animated GIFs.
Oh. This is kind of like having a stock theme or something. So eventually you'll see the same picture on like five different sites.
We still laugh about this because we still have
a
theme for, we got to make our own. We should do that tonight because
terrible. I have a template started, but I haven't finished it.
You're a busy guy. I understand. But yeah, avoid stock photos. You know, when you go to another website and you're like, I've seen that lady with a laptop before. There are always these multicultural pictures too. And you're like, I really find it improbable that there is a group of people where there are no two people of the same ethnicity at all out of 12. But that just seems statistically wrong. And they always have laptops. There's never a desktop computer in stock photography. It's always like people leaning over the laptop like, haha, look at my business presentation, Jill.
This one seems like an obvious one to a developer, but maybe not. To some people, is making your images bigger from a smaller source, just deep, like pixelating it, like, or stretching it, skewing the image. It's just terrible.
Yeah, that's horrible. Don't do that. And then
animated GIFs, be careful with those.
Oh, yeah, you have to, because
like don't even use them unless it's absolutely necessary. Yeah, exactly.
There's sometimes where you have to, and you feel so dirty and greasy doing it, but you have to sometimes.
Be careful with those.
If you are going to use it, though, there's so many good Creative Commons image searches. We've talked about a couple, like the Morgue file. You can do a Flickr search for Creative Commons stuff. There's so much good Creative Commons photography out there. Just make sure it's the right Creative Commons license, and then use that and give people credit because they're giving you good pictures for free.
Number 16, don't startle your visitors.
Yeah.
Don't have just a random audio sample or something playing in the background when you go to the site. Their speakers are like jacked up. Yeah. And you're like, whoa, what's going on?
Hey, Mark, you've won a free Nintendo Wii.
Yeah. What episode was that? Like,
five or 16 or something. Yeah.
Don't forget titles on pages.
This happens a lot. I'm really surprised. First of all, it's so important to SEO.
Oh, it's one of the most important things.
Yeah.
It's way up there. It's in the top 10. And it doesn't look good.
No, it just looks, here's what I did. I thought, we talked about SEO at one point, and one of the topics that came up was like, if you have a blog, put your article title and then your website name. And I always thought, I hate that. I want the website name first. It looks so much better. You know, Montana Frightfest, and then the article name. Well, one day I was just playing around doing Google searches for stuff, and I saw all these websites that...
They do it the other way.
They had just the way I like it. Oh, okay. They had the site first and then the title. And I thought, well, that's totally useless in a search. Because if I'm searching, I want to see the content of the title that was relevant to my search, not my site name. And that's when it clicked. I was like, those guys are thinking the same way I was. And it's not the way to do it.
What's even better, I hate to say it, break it, but is just to leave your blog name off completely.
I
know.
I can't do that. My OCD just would pop out of my head and stab
then they
you.
Just, they see the content, what they're searching for, and then they click on it, and then they can see your logo and different things. But
I can't do it.
Number 18 is keep your code organized.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, if you've got a bunch of external JavaScript calls, like five different frameworks just because you've added a little widget and you've got a big mess going on.
Again, this is only impressing the hardcore nerds that would look at your page source.
It is, but
ridiculous people like you that look at page sources all the time. I'm gonna have to say,
I was looking at a site the other day with my netbook, and netbooks are low on resources. And if you've got a bunch of JavaScript on the page, you can hardly scroll.
Oh yeah,
you've got to be kind of careful of some of those kind of things.
I agree, but
this is kind of a developer's.
Even with a really beefy computer, you can feel that JavaScript slowness. Mm-hmm. You just notice a performance difference. On a netbook, it makes it unusable.
Right.
But on like a big, powerful, even desktop computer, you notice it. You're like, this is not smooth like it should be. So you should just not be doing that anyway.
It's kind of a developer pet peeve thing. Yeah.
Number 19, check for broken links.
This is a big one.
The Google developer or the Google
web developer.
Webmaster Tools. Google Webmaster Tools. It'll tell you anything pointed to a link of yours that's broken. It'll find all your 404s. Do that if you know.
Yep.
And this is also a great chance for you to look at your 404 page, your 500 pages to make sure that they're relevant and useful. They're not just generic. So if something does go wrong, people aren't sort of just left in the dust going, ugh.
Yeah, maybe give them a search box or something to help them find this stuff. The broken links also. Like you might have a page, 5 years ago, and then you switch to a different URL, but some other page is still linking to that one. Go use the Webmaster Tools and use this opportunity to redirect that link to maybe the newer piece of content or just your homepage or something.
Yeah, exactly. I agree.
It's free PageRank. It's about the fastest SEO you're going to get to absolutely increase it.
Which is nice because WordPress does all the 301s automatically for you if you change your article titles. We were kind of worried about this for a while because sometimes I'll save an article without giving it a category, and my URL structure is one that it uses the category. If you forget to, it's always undefined, and I'm always like, oh, man. But if I still go back to that old undefined article,
301s,
it'll 301 back to the regular one, which is great. Makes me happy. Number 20 is be careful with ads. You have to be careful with ads. A lot of new ads, new sites overload with ads because they want to see the money right away.
Yep.
I'm kind of in this point where I removed all the ads from Montana Frag Fest, and I'm kind of thinking I might put just one or two little ones back in because I kind of got like on a big no ad kick.
For me, a good example of this is the click here to skip the ad, and they do a full page ad before you get to see your content. And then also they've got like five pages to read the one article.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's broken down into like this
two paragraphs,
and you got to see all these ads, and it's just really
that
annoying.
Infuriates
a lot of these like big old newspaper,
yep,
like
New York Times.
They get very annoying where I'm just like, I'm out of here.
Yeah, I agree. You got to be careful with your ads. Number 21 is ensure cross-browser compliance. This is really important. We talked about browser shots 2 weeks ago, was it?
This, depending on what sector you're kind of in, this can make or break your company.
Yeah.
If you optimize for IE and Firefox is just totally broken, you just lost 20-some percent
of your users. Oh, especially if you're like a tech blog. Because most tech-savvy guys are using Firefox. If you're doing an e-commerce website and you're not supporting IE7, maybe even IE6,
if
it's totally broken in IE6, then you're losing sales. Yeah, there's a lot of older people who are just starting to spend money on the internet using older browsers.
Yep. Number 22, have good error management. This is good.
Man.
I mean, this is kind of like the Twitter fail whale. Kind of shed a little bit of not the lighter side of, hey, we've got a problem. We're human.
Yeah, exactly.
Things like this happen.
The stumble upon maintenance page. Have you seen that? It's like stumble upon is working on it. Go outside and play. And they have like this little kind of play area. It looks great.
Yeah. It's like the lighter side. It's like, and also if you're seeing this page a lot, give us some feedback, but it's probably just a server error. Mm-hmm. If you redirect the page or come back in a few minutes, it'll probably be good again.
Yeah. So like this is a good time to talk about the different sort of HTTP statuses. A 404 means the content was not found, which is a great time to put like a search box in because they're looking for content on your website that isn't found.
Yeah.
So or even, if you have a search box or do an auto search and display those results on the 404 page. But like a 500 is a code error. It's an internal server error. So that's like a good time to say, hey, we're having a problem. We know about it. Yeah, exactly. You wouldn't want to put a search on that because their search will just lead to stuff that probably won't work anyways if you have an internal error.
Yeah, and I think we talked about this in one of our episodes. Google has a custom error page script, like JavaScript.
Great.
You just embed it in your 404 page, and it'll do searches on your site and provide a relevant search by the URL that they tried to use.
Great, great, great. So we'll link to that in the show notes because that's pretty useful.
Okay.
All right. So those are 22 things you can do right now to make your website more credible.
All right. What's our next topic, Jade?
Our next topic is a back to school special
extravaganza.
Extravaganza
of web apps. For
yeah,
school.
Exactly. So, you and I mean, I just a year ago graduated college. So I was a student for a long time, way longer than I would have hoped. My wife is still a student. What was it? 2-3 years ago?
Oh,
3-7,
I want to say.
Yeah. So about 2 years ago, yep. You graduated.
I wish I had some of these web apps that we're about
me
to
Me too.
Talk
I use some of
I've
these
used some
and
of them,
I,
but
wish
I
had. Right. Yeah, exactly. So, if you know, this maybe not for high school, but if you're definitely going to college, these are going to be a lot of helpful tips and apps and stuff to get you rolling the right way. Yep. So, what's the first killer thing you need to do if you're a student, Mark?
Collaborate with other students.
Exactly. It's all about team-based stuff anymore.
Yep.
Very, you know, almost in any discipline, it's all about teamwork, working together. We're going to, you know, it's a big thing in sort of the management world right now. You know, you don't work solo, work with teams and all this stuff. So you're going to be doing a lot of collaboration.
And one way to collaborate, and we do it actually all of our show notes when we do our show is in Google Docs.
Google Docs. Yeah. Yeah. So there's three basic Google apps or Google Docs. There's documents, spreadsheets, and presentations,
mm-hmm.
right? And now you can add things like files and stuff, if I remember correctly, but...
Yeah, they have templates and things, like...
Yeah. So the best part about these is you can work on these things at the same time.
You know, this is great if you're just sitting down with a meeting with your peers and you have to take notes or something. Why take notes in Word and then I have to, like, take the flash disks and, like, swap them around?
Oh, exactly.
Or, like,
if you're writing a paper, like, you usually as a group you go, okay, well, Jade, you've got the intro and this paragraph on what this happened. And so then when you comes in, everybody brings in their USB drive and you open a master document, you plug theirs in, open it up, copy and paste. This is perfect. Google Docs for documents, it's not the greatest for like formatting. You can't do like super fancy formatting and stuff like that,
mm-hmm.
but it's absolutely great for just getting content into a doc or a presentation or a spreadsheet together, you know, at the same time without having to do all that goofy flash drive passing around junk.
So when I went to school, I was the RTA. It was kind of like the resident technical assistant. I had to help students with their kind of computer problems, whether it be in the lab or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the most common thing was I was saving my stuff on a floppy disk or even on the computer hard drive. And it's like I lost it or it's gone and my computer crashed and my 5-hour paper is gone. Can you help me?
Yeah.
Well, probably not. But Google Docs. is saving constantly. You're not going to have this kind of a problem. It has revision control, so you know if you accidentally delete a paragraph, you're like, oh shoot, well, you know.
Yeah, you can go back to previous versions. And you can see differences between versions, who edited what. It's stored in the cloud. This is the benefit of cloud computing. It's not in one spot for it to get lost. It's in Google's magical file cloud where you don't have to worry about it. And as long as you have access to the internet, you can edit it.
Yep. Or you can see like who put that silly sentence in there. You can see who did it.
Who doesn't know how to spell? Yeah, and that was.
But
Mark.
It's got a built-in spell checker.
Yeah, it does. And but like we said, it's not. You know, it's like
it's not a full-featured word processor.
No, yeah,
like
Microsoft
Word
you use, let's say, you know, 20% of the features, 95% of the time. Right. Google Docs has that 20% of the features that you're going to need to write most of your stuff.
And you know, like you could write your paper in here and then transfer it to Word later.
Yeah,
and just kind of like
and
fix
like
it
clean
up a
it up.
Bit.
Yeah. So that's what I would.
This way, you never lose your paper. Yeah.
Or if you ever had to work on a presentation in a group, oh, it's such a pain because everybody does their own theme and stuff. But this way, you know, you just all work on your basic slides. You just say, hey, just work on your slides, get your content in there. Yeah, then maybe yank it out as a PowerPoint file if you want, and then go do all the fancy transitions and stuff that all those people want. But the whole point is it's a good way to collaborate on content and get it done.
Now, our next app with Dropbox, you could use Word and then still have the ability to give it to everybody. To transfer to all your different computers and kind of work in the cloud still.
Yeah, what Dropbox is, it's a synced storage that you install on your computer, and as you change files, it recognizes that you changed it and uploads it to its server and then distributes it to all the other computers you have running Dropbox.
And it does revision control as well.
Same thing, it does revision control. If you want, you can take a file and put it in the public folder and then get the public URL, and you can send that URL to people to download it from the internet. It's really useful. You and I use it for our projects. Like, I have my projects in a Git repository in Dropbox, so that I can just go to any of my computers and I know it's up to date. I don't have to go to a computer and do, you know,
like pull it down.
Yeah, pull it down from a central repository. It's just kind of there.
Yep.
It's great.
You know, when I went to school, it was the flash drives.
Oh, of course.
And that was like hip, you know, like a lot of people use like the floppy disks and stuff. Or you email it to yourself, or, you know, everyone's got their little trick they use. But like you'll be working in your dorm room, and then, oh, it's time to go, I gotta go, and then you're across campus, and then, you know, oh, I gotta do a little quick change in here, and you go to like the local computer lab, and then, you know, what do you gotta do? You gotta look in your email and pull it out and save it, mm-hmm. and then re-email it back to yourself. Yeah. And then you got this problem, you got these files laying all over the place. Which one's the most recent one? And
exactly.
With Dropbox, a little bit easier.
Yeah, oh, it's absolutely easy. You get 2 gigs for free with a free account. And then what it's like for $10 a year or something, you can get like 50 or nice. It's, I don't know the pricing. I'll look it up. Or we'll link to it in the show notes. But the basic free 2 gig one, I have yet to run out with. I mean, as long as you're not putting like movies and stuff on there, you have to do a lot of work to fill up 2 gigs.
Yeah, it's nice.
So Dropbox is great. I can't recommend it enough. Another one, if you have just Linux, another one that is coming out is called Ubuntu One. Yep. It's basically a clone of Dropbox, but Dropbox, they have it for Mac, Linux, Windows. It's
and that's
great.
What I need, because I have so many computers with different operating systems and things. I have my gaming computer, and I got my work computer, and I got a little laptop. And
yeah, exactly. Or it's nice. It's just so nice when I'm at work. You know, I have a Mac at work, so it's like, oh, maybe I want to do some work at home. Mm-hmm. All right, because I don't have a laptop at work anymore. I just throw the files in there.
Yep. Yeah. There's some cool stuff. Like for a developer, you can, sync up certain config files, and there's some cool things you can do with Dropbox.
Yeah. It's great. I love it. The next little one is, this one's kind of devious, but it's ratemyprofessors.com.
I have to say, I used this in school and I'm glad too. I did, because it's spot on.
Yeah.
And I looked at it last night to make sure it's still relevant. And the professors that I recognized, they had the descriptions down to a T.
Yeah, exactly. So it's just a site you go on and you tell it where your school is. And if you want, you can break it down by department, or you can just browse all of it. But it's just people that submit ratings for professors.
Yep. And they've got all kinds of ratings. Like, are they easy? Yeah. Do they teach you a lot of stuff? Do they help you after hours a lot?
Yeah. Well, you've all had that teacher, or you're talking to your classmates and you're like, oh man, how about that 231 homework? That was just brutal. And they're like, we didn't have any 231 homework. And you're like, wait, who's your teacher? And they're like, oh, this other guy. And you're like, so you guys have like a 4-page assignment every week, right? And they're like, no, once every 3 weeks we have a 10 question quiz. And you're like, oh man,
I got the wrong guy.
Yeah, exactly. So this is great for that. I don't know how politically correct this is, but there's also a hotness scale, so that if you want to find the attractive teachers, you can
upload
that.
A picture of them and say the hotter not of professors.
Yeah. But like you said, I use this. I've actually, when I had a couple really good professors, I made it a point to go on there and give them really good ratings. Because I felt like they deserve it, and other people should know that, maybe this guy isn't the easiest. He's not the hardest. He's not the easiest, but you'll learn a lot more because they're really passionate about their subject matter.
Yep. So it's a great website.
The next thing that we want to talk about is what we talked about in episode 27. This is a pretty quick one. We talked about it earlier too. PDF to Word. Mm-hmm. It's just, if you have a PDF file that you want to edit yourself, like sometimes teachers will give you a syllabus or something. Maybe you want to just throw some notes on there. Convert your PDF file to a Word doc. If it's a giant image, you can use OCR terminal to convert it to text as well.
Yeah, if you've got like a presentation and you got to pull in some information, but you want to cut some stuff out and just display that, or, something like that, and it's only in a PDF, you could use this to pull it out, or OCR, the OCR one.
OCR terminal, yep. Next one is absolutely essential. I used it, Google Calendar.
Yep. This one's so awesome. And before I kind of used Google Calendar, I used my cell phone's little own built-in calendar system to, give me alerts and things, at 6, if I had to go to a presentation at 7 o'clock or something, at 6:30, I'd be like, hey,
yeah,
like, exactly. Oh dang, I have to go to that stupid presentation. Yeah, but it was a lifesaver.
Yeah. Google, the great part about Google Calendar is you can have as many calendars as you want. So you can have like a personal calendar, and you can just have your class schedule in a separate calendar. Yep. So it's really not yours, but if you want to get reminders for it, you still can. And so that way, you, if you want to just view just your class schedule, you can uncheck all the other calendars and just view your class schedule. And then you can share it with other people. You can make it publicly viewable.
Yeah, that's a great thing. Like if you're trying to set up a meeting, it's like, well, what times do you have? You know, here's my class schedule here. Here's the link to it.
Well, speaking of making meetings, which is if everyone's on Google Calendar, it's really easy to make meetings because you add yourself as a friend.
Not everybody's on it.
Not everybody is. That's when something like a web app like Doodle comes in really handy. So with Doodle, you just go in. We talked about this, I think, episode like one or two a long time ago. You just go in and you mark the times that you're available, and then you email that link to everyone else you want a thing in, and they go in and mark which times they're available. And then whichever time, you know, has everyone's available or the best time for everybody, then you can select it from the Doodle thing and make an appointment there.
Yep. A lot of the projects are all team-based, and this is...
Scheduling time to meets is so difficult. And the nice thing, like, some new features about Doodle is they have, like, well, yes, and then you can also enable, like, only if we absolutely have to, which happens a lot with students. Like, a lot of times, like, you absolutely can't meet during class. Obviously, you have to be in class. But maybe you have this hour where you are going to study for a test, but if no one else can meet at any other time, okay, we can meet during that time. That makes sense. But it was always a pain to schedule with groups and teams. I hated it.
Well, I'm busy. I got to go to work at that time. It's like, well, what times are you free? Well,
yeah. So use something like Doodle.
The next app is a little silly one. It's Ultimate Decision Maker. I use this in school to like, you know, the little decisions like, oh, should I go to eat right now? I'm kind of hungry. Or should I go study? I probably should study. But
that's not what you told me. You used it to decide whether or not you should go to class.
Not like every day, but yeah, like it's a simple, it's like flipping a coin, but it adds a little of excitement because there's these two little spiders and it's like these random number generators and they race to the end. And so, and it actually takes like a minute or 30 seconds or something to finish. So you click on it and you're like, oh, go. Oh, yes. You're like,
nose winning.
Oh, nose winning.
No. Oh, no. Yes. What are you doing? Oh, yes. Is pulling out ahead. Yeah. It's just kind of a fun way if you are indecisive to let it make a decision for you. You know, like yes for pizza, no for burgers.
Yep.
Oh, that one was down to the wire.
It's better than just flipping a coin because it's over. You know, you flip it and it's like, oh, I guess I gotta go do that.
Yeah, this is what.
But it's like, oh, I almost got it. The next one is Textbook Revolt. You know, we talked about the rental. What was the rental one?
Oh.
Where you can rent the textbook for a little bit less than just like purchasing it and then selling it back at the end of the semester. Textbook Revolt is actually. It's kind of like a swap. It's like I have this textbook and I need this textbook, and you just kind of swap them.
That's great.
With the person.
That's great. Like you just put up what you have. And,
And if somebody's got that, if somebody's like, oh, I took psychology last semester, but I'm taking the class that you're going to take, you can just swap it.
Yeah. It's funny because this happens locally a lot, but it's right, just, but you it's have a very limited pool because you don't know everybody in campus. So this is a great way to do it. And the other one, we'll put the link in the show notes. If you can't get it on Textbook Swap, especially if you're like an incoming freshman taking big seminar courses, the books from the rental place are really cheap. When you get into really upper division specialty stuff, it's kind of debatable whether or not it's cheap, but you can get like books for, you know, freshman level seminar classes for like $10 for a semester. And that's just dirt cheap because the rest, they'll bleed you dry.
Yeah, textbooks will. You know, they have a tie-in with Facebook. And so, you know, in Facebook, you can say what classes you have and things. And it's also specific to your university. Like your economics class is probably going to use this certain book in your university, and this other university is going to use this one. And if you kind of tie in with that Facebook kind of thing, you might get a lot more relevant.
Yeah.
People to swap with.
There's also the Facebook Marketplace. People post a lot of books on there. Especially that's one that's good because it's sort of sorted by your university. So the odds are there'll be a lot of books that you might have to take anyways. So check that out as
well. Don't be spending all your time Facebooking. You study.
Yeah.
I can't tell you how many times I went to the computer lab and every single person was on Facebook.
I know. I can neither confirm nor deny I spent quite a bit of time in my college youth on Facebook.
I did too.
So the next thing we want to talk about is note-taking applications. There's a lot of them out there. A really good sort of web-based and not web-based one is called Evernote. I really like Evernote. You can use it through a web-based interface, or they have desktop applications for each of them that syncs to the web service. Yep.
And cross-platform, Linux and the different ones. And
I don't think they have Linux.
I thought they did.
I don't think
I thought it wasn't as good.
No.
They have an iPhone app, though, which is cool.
That's way cool.
If you're on the go and you've got to check out what you put in your little notes, the iPhone, perfect.
Yeah. You don't want to pull out your
if you've got
laptop while you're watching. Evernote's good. You shouldn't. Note taking is not good in a word editor, mm-hmm. a text editor. It's just not good. Notes are not designed that way. If you have a Windows box, I have to say it's not a web app, but I have to recommend Microsoft OneNote. I had a tablet PC in school, and even if I wasn't using the tablet functionality, OneNote is an amazing program.
I heard it was good.
It's so flexible. It's great for taking notes. That's a problem with.
Did you take notes with a laptop?
Yes, absolutely.
Did you?
Did you find that
was a good way to go?
Oh, absolutely. Okay. I hate writing notes. And it sounds silly that I got a tablet PC, but the reason I got a tablet PC was for math notes. Because math notes, you can't just take on a regular laptop without kind of being goofy about it. Mm-hmm. But this with a tablet PC and OneNote, I could take math notes, and then for regular classes, I could type notes because I can type so much faster than I can write.
Huh.
And it's when I write, I have to look down at it. And if I have a laptop, I can type while looking at the professor and maintaining eye contact and seeing what he's writing on the board.
Interesting. As an RTA for the university, I was always asked by the parents of the students, like, I need to get my computer or laptop. Do they take laptops and take notes all the time? I was like, well, not really. There's like only like 3 or 4 people usually that bring a laptop.
Yeah, there wasn't a lot. I mean, when I was at the school, it wasn't until the tail end that a lot more people started bringing laptops in. But I would say, as for me and my education, it was absolutely essential. Mm-hmm. I had all the notes that for 3 years of college in my laptop. Yeah, you can search through it. You can do little to-do markers on it. I really like OneNote, but if you don't want it does cost money. It's not free. It's part of the office. It does cost money. My tablet PC came with it, so I didn't have to pay for it. But if I didn't get that, I would have used something like Evernote.
Yep, Evernote's an alternative if you don't want to pay for it.
Exactly. The next one is EasyBib. There is nothing, in my opinion, worse than writing a bibliography. Like, it's like pulling teeth. Yeah. I hate it.
What was that MLA format again? What was the APA? And you got the strict professor that, like, if you have a colon after it or something, it's like, oh, that's wrong. This is, garbage. You're
improperly referenced paper.
They have, I'm sure you guys are familiar with it, but they have styles of doing bibliographies, and they're very, very strict, and they have to be done a certain way. And EasyBib, you just type in your sources and where you found them, and it does it for you.
Yep, exactly. And it'll spit it out in a nice formatted way, and you can kind of keep a list of all your references as you go, and then when you're done, and it'll make it all for you. So can't beat it.
The next one is LogMeIn.
Yep. LogMeIn is great.
So LogMeIn is a remote access for compute, work from the computer lab on your own computer at home, and kind of like this remote access deal.
Yeah, exactly. So, let's say you're at home working on your desktop, typing up this paper, like, oh man, I'm working hard on it. I'm not using Dropbox because I'm stupid.
Or you forgot or to put it in the
I
Dropbox.
I forgot to put it in Dropbox and I'm typing it, and then, oh shoot, I got that meeting with my group right now. And then we get to campus and they're like, oh, okay, hey, so where's our paper? Oh,
it's on my computer at home.
Oh, man. No problem, because you installed LogMeIn. You go to logmein.com.
And it's free, by the way.
It's free, and you pull up this. It works. They have them for they have Windows and Mac. I don't think they have for Linux.
It traverses the NAT, so you don't have to mess with port forwarding and routers and things like that.
So you just go to logmein.com, and it shows all your computers that are currently connected, and you hit that one, and you remote control it, and there's your desktop on your remote computer. You can save it, move it to your Dropbox, and get to it from campus.
The next one is ZapReader. If you've got a big, long, boring reading assignment and you just want to just read it as fast as possible,
plow through it.
You know, we talked about this in a few episodes before. ZapReader, it flashes words on the screen so you can read, what is it, 300 times faster or 300%?
It has different degrees in which you can change the speed. I found that its default speed was a little too fast, so I slowed it down. But the whole point is that, because you're not like moving your eyes and things like that, is your eyes are focused in one spot, so you're able to read a lot faster.
And it's moving so fast that you can't sound out the words with, you got to see the word.
Yeah.
And that's,
So there you go. Any more tips for students involving, web technology or anything, just go to faceoffshow.com/feedback. Let us know.
Put it in the comments if you've got a favorite back-to-school app that you've got.
Yeah, exactly. How did you guys get through school using web technology? There's got to be some fairly young listeners out there that I mean, I would say that
I had to use that when, blackboard.
Yeah, when you know when we graduated, the whole sort of cloud computing web app revolution was, you know, really not in full swing. I mean, right now it is going crazy. Mm-hmm. There are, I mean, we find this doing the web app section for the show. There is so much new stuff coming out. It's kind of crazy. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I'm curious to hear what other people used, or if, you know, you got some of those old guys out there that just said, I've used a legal pad with a 3-ring notebook, so shut your mouth, Robbins. I want to hear that. So let us know how you guys got through school, and we will see you guys next week.